From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Phil Mendelson, the chairman of the D.C. Council. We'll also be talking first, however, with Aisha Braveboy, the state's attorney for Prince George's County. She is a Democrat. She joins us by phone. Thank you so much for joining us, Aisha Braveboy.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate you understanding I couldn't make it in today. You know, I love coming down to your studio, but unfortunately today I couldn't make it.
We will never forgive you.
800-433-8850. If you have questions or comments for Aisha Braveboy, you better call now. Aisha Braveboy joins us by phone. But before we go to Aisha Braveboy, Tom Sherwood, Governor Northam of Virginia and lawmakers there have been urging local authority over Confederate monuments. The Richmond City Council asked for the state for authority to decide the fate of its Confederate iconography. But this has been an ongoing debate for a long time, and it would seem as if Democrats in the Virginia legislature and the Virginia General Assembly are at this point disposed to giving this authority to local officials.
Virginia has the authority, the state legislature and the governor have the authority to pass legislation and get rid of them all, or to require that they be put into museums, or that additional statuary or information signs go up wherever they may be to explain some of the racist history of why they're there in the first place. I think this is a sign, because some of the African-American delegates are also supporting this. This is a way for the Democrats to take a stand against the statues, but also allow the local governments, the cities and the counties, to make their own decisions, many of which will make them pretty quickly, like Charlottesville, Richmond, and others, to change or move these statues from the public square and put them in historic perspective. I think it's a compromise that shows maybe the legislature and the governor are going to work on this and other issues.
On to Maryland, where I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg. On the one hand, the Maryland Board of Public Works has approved 2-1, with State Treasurer Nancy Kopp voting against and Governor Larry Hogan and State Comptroller Peter Franchio joining Hogan in supporting the expansion of I-270 and the Capitol Beltway. I say I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, because on Monday, State Comptroller Peter Franchio announced that he will be running for governor.
Well, the governor, if I can use the word, was railroading his highway plan through the state, and he was going to move quickly and start taking land around the Beltway and start changes on 270 and the American Legion Bridge. And Maryland, Montgomery, and Prince George's, and Howard, and other counties said, hey, wait a minute, you're going too fast, you're going to start taking land. And so Peter Franchio, who we talked about on this program months ago, planning to run for governor, and who has now said he will, there's only 3 votes on that board, and he and Nancy Kopp voted against, or delayed, not didn't vote against, delayed, told the governor to delay his plan till now.
So what changed Franchio's mind?
Well, Franchio, they got some pretty good changes which will help him when he runs for governor in the Washington suburbs.
In addition there to will which, be probably no, get support just, from Governor Hogan.
Well, I don't know
who's
about
a Republican.
That. But we'll see. But, you know, there are a few key changes in the governor's $9 billion plan. One is that they will not start taking property along the Beltway 495 until the governor, in fact, has his public-private partnership contract in place, and people will know exactly what's going to happen. People will not be losing their homes. The governor had done nothing on bus rapid transit. And so there's an agreement now, I think, to spend some like 10% of the monies raised on transit, that buses will be allowed to free into express lanes. And this plan also, whatever happens on 495, there will be more environmental protections for Rock Creek Park, for Sligo Creek, I think it's called Northwest Park. I can't remember the name of it. And there also will be a focus starting on the American Legion Bridge, which is one of the great bottlenecks. So it's a very good move for
everyone. I don't know if that will change the minds of the Montgomery and Prince George's County officials who have opposed it, but we can hear from Aisha Braveboy about this. How do you feel about it?
You know, you're talking about the transportation project.
Yes.
You know, I try to stay in my lane, but what I do know is that, you know, mass transit is the direction that we need to go in, and that, you know, I support investing in smart transportation projects throughout the state. But I'm going to let the experts, you know.
Well, you have been in a lot of lanes. You've been in the General Assembly. You've run for governor. You're now the state's attorney.
You have to travel around the very large county of Prince George's County, and you know what traffic can be on Highway 4 and the Beltway and 50 and all those other roads. Do you have any view at all on this changes?
Well, you know, I've really been focused actually on criminal justice reform and also public safety in my county. And so to the extent that, you know, traffic or congestion impacts our ability to effectively perform our jobs in public safety, you know, certainly some concerns.
Now, can I just say very quickly on this subject, Tom Hucker, he's a council member from Montgomery County, you talked about who supports it. Mark Elridge and Tom Hucker particularly has put out statements. They do support what's happened, but Hucker has said, look, this is a good initial victory for the metropolitan Washington area, but that they have to keep their heat on to make sure these changes don't wither away when they start doing
and
details.
That an environmental impact study is done. Aisha Braveboy, this morning you were at the sentencing for Michael Duval, who was convicted in October 2019. For the stabbing death of a 20-year-old Prince George's County resident, it was a cold case. Attack took place back in 2005. Over a decade later, case was reopened. Is this result what you hoped for?
This is actually the result we hoped for. In fact, the sentencing is going on right now. We'll be doing a press conference right after the sentencing. Mr. Duval has been held accountable and responsible for his actions. And, you know, I think that this case really also sends the message that we will never rest until we get justice. Whether it's a cold case or a case that just occurred, we will work with our police agencies, our detectives, to investigate, to develop suspects, and to prosecute individuals who are responsible.
What now he faces, I think, up to 30 years.
Up to 30 years.
Now, what did the prosecutor, what did you recommend to the judge?
We recommended 30 years.
Okay.
And maybe while we're even talking to you, you might get a finding on this, or will you have to go back into court?
As soon as the judge sentences him, I'll get an alert from my communications team. And if it happens on this call, I'll let you know.
Okay, good.
Another recent case, the killing of Army Second Lieutenant Richard Collins III. Sean Urbanski was convicted of first-degree murder, but the hate crime charge was dropped. You argue that Urbanski's attack was racially motivated, and now you're planning to call on lawmakers to change the state crime statute. How do you think it needs to change?
Sure. Well, the judge, and we respectfully disagreed with the judge's decision in this case, but the judge believed that the hate crime statute was very narrow, and it would require us to prove that hate based on one of the protected classes, including, you know, African-American, someone, you know, who was killed based on their race, was the only factor in the person's actions, as opposed to one of several factors that could have been at play in the commission of a crime. And so we want to make sure that our statute is broad enough that if race is a factor at all, whether it's the sole factor or one of many factors, that we can prove or that we can make the elements of the hate crime statute. And so we're working with Delegate C.T. Wilson and Senator Joanne Benson, who happens to be a graduate of Bowie State University. And as you all may recall, Second Lieutenant Richard Collins III is a graduated post after his death, obviously, from Bowie State University, and he was also commissioned in the Army the day of his death.
Ms. Brayford, do you have legislation already written to, because it's difficult to, I mean, how do you determine what hate is in someone's mind unless they post racist things on websites or are quoted? But because I know you're meeting next week with Senator President, State Senate President, Mr. Bill Ferguson, brand new, and this is one of the issues you're going to bring up with him. Do you have precise legislation you're going to put on his desk?
Yes, we have language now that really tweaks the current hate crime statute to basically...
Tweaks? That doesn't sound very strong. What about rewrite?
Well, the thing is, the statute is pretty decent, but what it is it's too narrow. It is interpreted or was interpreted by the judge in this case to mean that we would have to prove, the state would have to prove that hate was the only factor in the commission of the crime. And the tweak would be that we would modify the language to say that if hate is the motivating factor or one of many factors, that it would meet the elements of the hate crime statute in order for us to seek a hate crime in a particular case. I think it just really needs to be broadened. And I think if it had broader language like what we are going to be suggesting, we would not have run into the problem that we did with the judge.
Another thing you're trying to change is how strangulation cases are convicted. Right now, strangulation cases are charged and prosecuted as misdemeanors. You want it to be a first-degree felony. Do you get a sense that Maryland lawmakers would be open to making it a first-degree felony?
Absolutely. I mean, we've had a lot of great support from legislative leaders in Annapolis around this issue. Maryland is one of only, I think, about four states that...
And the District of Columbia.
And the District of Columbia, that's correct. So we're going to call on our partners in the District of Columbia to also consider this, that does not consider strangulation a first-degree felony assault. You know, strangulation is the most lethal form of domestic violence. And if you think about what a person experiences when they are strangled, they can be rendered unconscious within seconds, and they could die within just
a few
minutes.
So what's the nature of the opposition to making it a first-degree felony?
Well, we have not run into opposition just yet. I think in the past, the leaders of the House and Senate committees that oversaw, you know, this type of legislation were not in favor of it. I believe that we now have leaders in the House and Senate that are more open to this type of legislation.
Are there statistics to show that most strangulation cases involve, in fact, men against women?
Yes, I mean, because a lot of this is a result of domestic violence, and we know that 75% to 80% of the domestic violence cases involve a male abuser and a female victim, and it's not to say that men cannot be victims, and so we know that we have a lot of support also of men in the legislature who also believe that it's important for us to pass such legislation, but I believe that we're going to have the support this year. I know the vice chair of the Judiciary Committee on the House side, Vanessa Atterbury out of Howard County, is our lead sponsor, and Senator Susan Lee from Montgomery County is our lead Senate sponsor.
We don't have a lot of time, so let me ask you about homicides. You have said guns are a problem in Prince George's County, that you are going to, quote, vigorously prosecute gun crimes. What are you going to do different that hasn't been done in the county before?
Well, we have continuously prosecuted gun crimes, and you know, we have an over 90% conviction rate with respect to our homicides.
Are you looking to changes in the law, or are you just going to keep focusing?
What we need to really focus on is prevention and sending, you know, that message to our community that that gun crimes are unacceptable, that having and possessing illegal weapons is unacceptable in our community, that we will prosecute individuals that possess or who possess illegal weapons in our community, and we're going to do our best again to hold everyone accountable to the maximum extent. But a lot of it is a public campaign around the dangers of having guns, because a lot of times people who would not make the decision to, let's say, kill someone or to injure someone, when they have that gun, they believe they're more powerful, and then they make bad decisions because they have that weapon. And so our goal is to send the message to not engage in carrying illegal weapons.
I'm not sure the campaign to ask people, you know, there was a Don't Smoke the Brothers campaign here in the district during the worst days in the 90s. I'm not sure how a campaign would do that, but you do intend to prosecute, and that will be a strong message too.
We do intend to prosecute, but we all are also about prevention. So we have to do our part to educate the public as well, and that's what we're going to do.
Your office announced in September that you would no longer request cash bail as a condition of release. Why was this a priority, and have you seen any changes since eliminating the cash bail system?
Yes, I mean, it's a priority because we did not want to, run a system of justice where individuals were treated differently based on their ability to afford a cash bail. And so what we have seen is judges being a lot more thoughtful about the types of pretrial conditions that they are giving to defendants. Certainly individuals that are a danger to the community, we ask that they remain held without bail. And so we've been able to successfully keep violent criminals off of our streets. But for individuals who, you know, are not considered a danger to the community, not considered a flight risk, there have been, improvements on their conditions of release. The judge just handed down a 30-year sentence against Michael Duval, so the judge did give us what we asked for.
What are we doing with marijuana prosecutions in Prince George's County? In the district, in suburban Virginia, there are new prosecutors taking office who say they will not prosecute misdemeanor marijuana cases and will seriously consider trying to move those cases away from prosecution. What are you doing with marijuana cases?
Sure. We really just focus our prosecution on the distribution cases and the interdiction cases here in Prince George's County. So we're focusing on drug dealers and those who are sending drugs through packages in the mail and things like that. And we're very successful in that, and focusing our efforts and those of the police department on the more serious offenders is really yielding good results for us.
Do you have a candidate for governor yet? We mentioned earlier before you came on, Phil, Peter Franchot is running for governor. I know it's early. Are you supporting Aisha? I'm not sorry.
Angela
Alsobrooks. Brooks. You both start with A. Angela Alsobrooks.
You know, Angela is a
yes or no
executive. She's doing a great job. I don't know what the future holds for her. She has not made any decisions, so I'll just withhold judgment on that until I figure out what the field looks like.
We got a tweet from Kyle. What are State Attorney Brave Boy's thoughts on recent incidents of small municipal police officer misconduct? He's talking about the former Fairmont Heights, Maryland police officer who was accused of a serious breach of public trust, raping a woman who he arrested during a traffic stop in December 2019.
Well, our office is prosecuting that case, and we have prosecuted both Prince George's County police officers as well as municipal police officers who abuse their power. And so we will continue to hold them accountable as well.
Finally, your office established a conviction and integrity unit. What does that unit do?
So our Conviction and Sentencing Integrity Unit, which is one of the first in the country that reviews both conviction integrity issues, you know, someone who wants to claim their absolute innocence, and also sentencing integrity, meaning that individuals who believe they were disproportionately sentenced have an ability to ask us to review their sentence and to request certain modifications. And so far that is going very, very well. In fact, we had our first juvenile lifer who we reviewed his sentence and determined that, his sentence was disproportionate. He was 16 at the time of his offense, and he was recently released into the community under monitoring, of course, as he goes through the reentry process. But that's going great, really, really well. We recently also received a grant from the U.S. Department of Justice to assist us with our conviction integrity efforts. And so we are in the process of hiring an investigator for those cases, and we have, you know, probably a couple dozen that we're reviewing right now. And we're working with Howard University School of Law and students there to help us review these cases. So I wanted to give a shout out to my alma mater.
Aisha Braveboy is the state's attorney for Prince George's County. She's a Democrat. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Phil Mendelson, the chairman of the D.C. Council, will join us. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Hi, it's Diane. The next meeting of my book club is on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll host a discussion of Mad Honey by Jodi Picco and Jennifer Finney Boylan, followed by a conversation with the authors. Find out more and register at dianereem.org/bookclub.
Welcome back. Our guest is Phil Mendelson. He is the chairman of the D.C. Council. He is a Democrat. Chairman Mendelson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Mayor Muriel Bowser, Tom Sherwood, is urging Virginia lawmakers to pass gun measures to help curb city violence. That's because she says that there's been a significant decline in the number of guns that enter the district from Maryland and a significant increase in the number of guns that enter the district from Virginia. And now that the Virginia General Assembly will be controlled by Democrats, I guess she feels that she has a better chance of getting those laws passed.
You know, Virginia is the Home Depot for guns going across the entire Mid-Atlantic region.
I think Home Depot would represent that.
Sorry, the Lowe's. How about the Lowe's? But, you know, it's nice for the mayor to send a letter to the Virginia legislature. They're going to do some gun control stuff. But it's the issue of illegal guns. You can purchase a gun with straw names. You don't have background checks. And so anything that the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, can do to pass gun control legislation would help the district quite a bit.
Okay. Phil Mendelson, Ward 2 Councilmember Jack Evans resigned on Tuesday. Were you expecting it? Tom Sherwood seems to have been predicting it forever here.
There was a lot of talk that that was the route he was going to take. But knowing it for sure, we didn't know for sure until Tuesday.
Yes, and when he handed you a letter, which was his resignation, I had thought he was going to say something, but I think he avoided quite the scene of people cheering and all that.
How did you become the first person in the media to see the letter?
Because I made a mistake.
Because I'm a good reporter.
I made a mistake.
It's very sneaky.
I haven't said who gave it to me.
Well, it was me.
It was just revealed.
He came out of his office in the route, and he was passing it out to whoever asked for it.
No, right? I passed it out to you.
Anyway, it was fine. It was public knowledge at that time. Here's the issue. Jack Evans has resigned, and the Board of Elections, this is because of its bureaucratic decision-making, has decided it will hold two elections. There will be the normal Ward 2 primary on June 2nd, and now it's going to hold a replacement election for the last 6 months of Jack Evans' term 2 weeks after that primary. Why can't – it's within the law. I talked to lawyers this very morning. Why can't both elections be on the same day, and could the council pass legislation to make that happen so that voters aren't – deluged by two separate campaigns where candidates have to raise two separate pots of money, have two separate ads, and then run in two elections.
And where the same candidates are likely to run anyway.
So why not just have two elections on the same day?
I think it's worth thinking about, but I understand what their reasoning is, and that is it's confusing to... It's like the initiative a couple years ago that was on the primary ballot. Mm-hmm. This is a primary election in June. And at the primary election, only those members of parties are to vote.
Right.
So if you have a special election, that's open to everybody.
Right.
So we're busy advertising that the primary election is on Tuesday. And meanwhile, actually, there's a special election that everybody can come and vote at. It created quite a bit of confusion a few years ago. And I believe the board's thinking is they want to avoid that. That's why, because it is technically two different elections.
Yes, it is. And again, you have to have two separate campaigns. But
and there would be two separate ballots.
And then the turnout on the special replacement election, it seems to me, would drop off. People would go vote on and then think they've done something, and then they have to vote again in 2 weeks. It seems to me a city could do a public relation, public campaign.
Or they could do a postcard election. That might be an approach. I think it's worth thinking about. But that is the reason for not having at the polls two elections the same day. Now, maybe the negatives, which is what you're pointing out, outweigh that decision.
It just seems that it can be done. And the War II is not that big of a geographical war.
70,000, 80,000 people.
Let people know that there's going to be two elections in Ward 2. It doesn't matter whether people in Ward 5 or 6 care or know about it.
That's true, but it still gets confusing. You go to the polling place and I give you two ballots. Why are you giving me two ballots?
Well, because you do an education campaign beforehand.
Okay.
Do you think Jack Evans, he's talked, I'm told, privately about running for these both of these elections. What do you think about that?
I think it's it's a long shot.
Well, maybe a long shot or it might be a slam dunk. What do you think about it?
I think it's a long shot. And it reminds me of in 1990, after Marion Barry was caught smoking crack, that he ran. People don't remember this.
He ran at large race
and he lost.
Hilda Mason's seat.
Yes,
he ran against Hilda Mason. She was the one person he couldn't defeat.
And I don't think voters are going to be forgiving that.
Did you hear that? Voters will not be forgiving that quickly of Jack Evans. But if he wins, will he get his committees back?
I'm not going to talk about committees at this point. But I think that
no.
I'm certainly not putting it in my calculation.
A lot of the scrutiny that Jack Evans faced with the ethics violations was due to the fact that he held an outside job, and now there are two bills before the council that would limit council members to one job, unless in the case of Brianne Nadeau's bill, it would allow for a teaching job. Kenyon McDuffie's bill doesn't. Where do you stand on council members holding second jobs? Do you have a second job?
No, he can't.
His
job is full-time.
But all the time that I was an at-large member before I became chairman, I did not have outside employment, and I think that council members, to be effective, have to give full-time to being a council member. But at the same time, I think there are unintended consequences when we say that those who hold office should not be of the community. That is, that we're going to isolate them and prohibit.
Citizen legislators.
Yeah, we're supposed to be citizen legislators. I do think, though, that we need to tighten up our rules with regard to the kind of employment, in the sense that if you're going to have clients, as in consulting, then you're going to have to do additional disclosure, and there are going to be some additional
I know your job is a full-time job, but does it say specifically that you cannot hold another job?
Correct.
Yes. Disclosure
the
is...
The Home Rule Act
prohibits. Isn't disclosure... I mean, I said this on the radio many times. Disclosure is the issue, whether it's city contracting, whether it's campaign financing, whether it's conflicts of interest, and certainly BEGA, the Board of Elections and Government Accountability, it's not that old of an agency, but needs to be reformed. It's not working very well. But it just seems if there is more disclosure. If you're a lawyer and you have clients, if you want to be a public official too, you disclose the clients. Normally you don't disclose clients if you're a lawyer. There are confidential issues involved there. But one of the things is, I think Brianne Nadeau's law, we'll exempt people in education. And that's because Mary Che is a law professor at George Washington. But education is one of the most politically charged issues in the city, whether it's local schools, the universities. Why would there be any exception? Do you think it ought to be all or nothing? More disclosure?
I think disclosure is underappreciated and also over-required. You know, under our current laws, we require almost every employee of the district government, or at least it's thousands and thousands, I would say maybe 10,000 or more, disclosure forms.
Every year in May.
I think it's overwhelming. A change I put in the council's rules a few years ago is that council members have to disclose twice a year. I don't know if folks realize that.
Very vague disclosures.
Yeah. And
just like the Congress.
And I think the disclosures should be, we should look at it and look at it with an eye of it being more specific. The disclosure, in my view, is what's important. When you have prohibitions, then people try to find ways around the prohibition. When you have disclosure, then, you know, it's out there in the open.
What about reforming the Board of Elections and Government Accountability?
BEGA?
BEGA is begging for reform.
BEGA, you noted, I think you noted, maybe not, you said it was dysfunctional. Right now they don't have an executive director, or they haven't
acted. Yes, he quit with good reason.
And the auditor did, Kathy Patterson did an audit last fall that indicated that there were a lot of complaints that hadn't been acted on.
It's not aggressive enough in just routine things.
I have to say that it did not help us at the council with the allegations against Mr. Evans that Bega was supposedly looking into it, but then not looking into it. And which is it? And, you know, they came out with an agreement with Mr. Evans in the summer, which basically just regurgitated what the council had done.
It recalls that when Marion Barry first ran for mayor, he complained about the Walter Washington administration as stumbling and bumbling.
So what are your thoughts on how the Office of Government Ethics should be reorganized or move forward?
Or at least do their job.
I don't know that the law needs to change with regard to the structure, but I do think that the BEGA needs to be much more responsive to the public and to the council. I don't want to limit it just to the council when there are complaints in doing these investigations.
The Washington Business Journal wrote a piece this week about what Evans' departure means for the business community, since he was seen as an ally. You dissolved the council's Business and Revenue Committee when you removed
Jack Evans from its
Finance and Revenue, and you moved Jack Evans from its chair position. How would you respond to those concerned about the city's commitment to local businesses, among them one Mayor Muriel Bowser? But we'll get to that shortly.
Well, we are seeing a dichotomy in the council. Those who are perceived as being very unfriendly to business and those who are moderate and, I don't know if I'd say business friendly, but at least not as antagonistic. I've heard recently speeches from colleagues that are very critical of individuals because they're tied to large businesses like Amazon. And I've also heard speeches just... The evil is Pepco, because it's a large utility or part of the Exelon Corporation.
It's and, like Dominion in Virginia.
So we're seeing increasingly this schism. And I think that's another way of looking at the Washington Business Journal's article, that somebody who was on one side of that schism is gone, and what does that mean for the balance in the council? And we'll see.
Do you feel the same way about D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser's remarks when she said some D.C. council members are enemies of economic development? One Tom Sherwood posted about that on Twitter.
Yes, I asked her that question this week at the Martin Luther King Gateway Development Project, which is a great thing for Anacostia, unless you look at it as the beginning of aggressive gentrification of that region. But when I asked her about this, because she had not said anything about Jack, I said, well, he was big on economic development, and that's when she said there are people who are, quote, as Kojo just said, enemies of economic development. And then she also added a racial aspect of it, that specifically talking about projects in Ward 7 and 8 east of the river. She clearly was talking about Alyssa Silverman, with whom she's had a lot of fights over issues. But who's an enemy of economic development, or would you use that word?
Well, when I heard that reported to me, and I didn't know you were the one who provoked the mayor.
Of course, I didn't provoke the mayor. I asked her a calm question, she did it.
He provoked her.
I gasped. That's certainly not the phrasing I would use.
Well, there obviously is a more nuanced approach to this issue, because there are clearly some council members, Tom mentioned one name, who do not like the idea of the kind of development that leads to gentrification and displacement, especially of people in the African-American community. And there are other council members who, it is presumed or assumed, are not that much concerned about it. They just want to see development take place in undeveloped areas in the city.
But they also are worried not just about who is getting the contracts with very little oversight, and
precisely,
who is making money and with sham subcontracting. Subcontracting is a mysterious netherworld, and a lot of people are making money off of subcontracts.
Well, the point you make, Tom, is a legitimate point.
Yes,
absolutely. But I would not characterize that as enemies of business.
Well, you and the mayor are barely, if on speaking terms, so I doubt that you'll be talking to her about her choice of words. But it does matter in the council about with the elections in Ward 4 and Ward 7 and Ward 2. Are you concerned at all that the council may move to a more progressive stance, where it, like across the nation and other places, that it won't be so much anti-business as a skeptical of business, in which Tony Williams used to say, if we don't have good business, we don't have the revenues to do the social work that we need to do.
Well, I think Tony Williams was right. I'll say that again. I think Tony Williams was right in the way you just characterized what he would say. I do have some concern that the city is doing very well, and it's doing well because of a mix of a lot of social justice work that the government's doing, as well as just a booming economy. We seem to have the right mix, and I think we need to be sensitive to any altering of the balance.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Phil Mendelson. He is chairman of the D.C. Council. If you have called, stay on the line. We will get to your calls. If you'd like to call, the number is 800-433-8850. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show or email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back. Our guest is Phil Mendelson. He is chairman of the D.C. Council. He's a Democrat, and we're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. Gentlemen, put on your headphones because I'm going to Eric here in Washington, D.C. Eric, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My question is for the chairman. Chairman Mendelson, you continue to push the breakup of the Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs, despite the fact that the majority of businesses and business groups who are the largest users of DCRA continue to state that this will create more delay, more backlog, and create more cost to businesses. Could you explain why this is the case?
Well, first of all, I don't agree with your premise that a majority of businesses oppose it.
On what basis do you make that statement, Eric?
Well, I represent the largest construction trade association in the region. You've had comments from the construction industry, the development industry, realtors and others who've all stated that this would create problems for them to do business. And
okay.
Still, the chairman and others have decided to go against the largest users of DCRA.
Your turn, Chairman.
Well,
Madison.
My recollection is that I've had two public hearings, and that there's been overwhelming support for the bill. And among business groups, most of them have been neutral. And I think that's because of pressure that was put on them by the mayor to oppose the bill. And I believe DCBIA is the only business group that has come out and said explicitly that they opposed the bill. The bill is about breaking up an agency that is dysfunctional. We get an unbelievable number of complaints about how poor a job that agency does in enforcing the housing code, which makes a huge difference with regard to low-income renters who are taken advantage of by bad landlords and slum landlords. And then that agency has done a miserable job in protecting the community against illegal construction. I was at a meeting last night where there was complaint about a house that is being reconstructed without permits. The city comes out to put in a stop work order after days and days and days of trying to get the city to DCRA to come out. And then the workers are right back at work and the agency doesn't do anything.
I think DCRA is terrible, although employment service is not much better. But, you know, businesses, like the gentleman just mentioned on the air, they have to hire facilitators who go down and stand in line.
Expediters.
Expediters, that's the new word.
And they get to pay for an expedited permit processing system,
right.
Velocity. And you pay $100,000 more than you would otherwise to get special treatment
Which
for a
I
permit.
Might add is a tax deduction on any taxes you pay to the district. So it seems to me the system doesn't work for the big businesses that have to pay a lot of money. And it doesn't work for the homeowner who wants a driveway change. So if you change DCRA to focus on the process, it would be better for the businesses, not worse.
I completely agree.
So where's the legislation?
The bill, I reintroduced the bill, and we are working on it this
Which
spring.
Committee is it in?
It's in my committee, the Committee of the Whole, and I'm working on it. I hope we'll be able to look at getting whatever fiscal impact
what
is
What do you
in
know
the budget.
So far about the administration and the head of the agency's office to reorganize the agency?
He's trying his best.
How much do you know about what's actually taking place?
Well, I do think that the new director, the current director, Ernest Trapa, is leagues better than his predecessor. But the agency is very challenged, and it has a huge responsibility from licensing to, they're the ones who do the, make sure that the gas pumps are accurate and weight, the scales are accurate, and but they're not doing the housing inspections.
Yeah, they don't go out on a lot of things, on any kind of, people can wait, talk about waiting for the cable repair person to come or something like that. If you're a business, you're waiting for someone to come inspect your business or to look at housing, you can wait forever, and it's they go out for certain hours of the week. It just seems to me that it makes sense to have a clear-cut business. Ever since Barry was first mayor, there's been an effort to reform DCRA,
yes,
but it's not functioning.
Well, under Barry, the several agencies were combined, and for a little while, that the new agency, the new DCRA, seemed to be doing pretty well. Right. But it has slipped back, and they're just not.
The good employees who work there, I go there a lot. Good employees who work there will tell me, not of course on the record, that they can't do their jobs because of the bureaucratic structure, the way it's done.
Yeah.
Jamie tweets, how does Chairman Mendelson plan on funding bills that have been passed? There is a long history of the Council of D.C. passing laws, but having no way or refusing to fund them. Initiative 77, for instance, would have raised tip workers' minimum wage to standard minimum wage by 2026. Voters approved that initiative in 2018. Council repealed it with the caveat that new provisions be created to help tipped workers, like creating a public awareness campaign about the rights of tipped workers, establishing an anonymous hotline to report wage theft and more. The Washington Post's Fennett Narapil recently reported that none of these provisions had been budgeted for, let alone created. You told the Post that in addition to the mayor should try it harder to include it in her budget, you would also note that the so-called self-proclaimed worker advocates did not lobby us, as far as I know. Does it take lobbying for the D.C. Council to do the right thing?
There were several parts to what you just said. The council members, plural, have a bad habit of passing legislation that's not funded.
Subject to appropriations.
And in the last council period, that's the last 2 years, the council passed something like 90 bills that were subject to appropriations, and at this point, 70 of them remain unfunded. It's a bad habit. And
as chairman, would you block that if you can? Can you change the council rules to say you have to have a financial impact statement with your legislation?
Council members would not go along. And sometimes, no, there is a fiscal impact, always a fiscal impact statement, but to be fully funded. And sometimes we know that a bill will be funded. So I think there would be bad consequences.
What's the
if
solution?
We just simply, I think members should be better disciplined and not be reporting out bills that sound good, that I can turn to you and say, I passed such and such bill, but it's not funded.
Well, how about we have a council rule that every time you pass legislation that is, quote, subject to appropriation, that's the first thing you see at the top of the bill. That way everyone knows that it's an aspiration, not a decision.
Well, we do something like that. When it goes to Committee of the Whole for clearance, I asked the budget director if the bill is funded.
No, I mean on the printed document itself. It's subject to appropriation.
It's on the record that it's not.
Or call it Disneyland.
But your
it's
remarks.
In the committee report. It's in the fiscal impact statement.
Yeah, but the public doesn't see
but your remarks
those.
Seem
but it's
to
also
suggest,
brought up at the Committee of the Whole meeting.
Your remarks seem to suggest that were the council lobbied about this, then it would have included it.
Well, I did throw that little dig in when Fennett interviewed me for that article, and I did because there were these advocates who were proclaiming about how important all this stuff was, and then when it came time to remind the council it should be funded, they were AWOL. And maybe that was not a nice thing for me to do, but that's
and
why
they
I threw
might
that
be
in.
AWOL. They also might just be unable to get the funding. I mean, it's hard enough
to get a bill
passed.
We get plenty of lobbyists at budget time who are telling us to fund this.
But they get exhausted trying to get the bill passed, and then they have to turn around and get it funded. It's a two-step waltz, and you can lose out.
I'm not quite sure I'm following you. The advocates for a lot of these bills are not shy and are not quiet when it's budget time, but on this one, they were.
They were not enemies of the city.
Let me add this as well, and that is that with this budget cycle, I'm going to remind the mayor that she needs to fund this in the budget, and see that we get this bill funded because it's important for worker protection.
How are you going to remind her? You guys virtually don't speak to each other. You're going to send her a letter.
I do talk to her from time to time.
The district plan.
Although I did send her a letter about the archives building, the new archives proposal.
Yes.
And that, 3 months later, I still don't have an answer.
Right.
Or maybe you should talk to her about that. The district plans to permanently clear the homeless encampment on K Street Northwest in Noma. Signs were posted late last week, and they say that starting on January 16th, all property blocking the sidewalk will be removed and disposed of. What do you think of this approach? I am reluctant to opine on it.
It is
okay. What he seems to be saying.
it's a really tough issue. I'm thinking of the K Street underpass where... you know, we have a law. People can be arrested for blocking sidewalks. It's incommoding.
Yes.
And yet there are tents on this sidewalk. And I think I heard that there were like 40 people living, 40. That's a lot of people living in this underpass.
Yes.
On the other hand, the problem here is homelessness. And the solution is to help these folks who think it's better for them to be living on the streets.
But there's not an easy answer here. Since 1975, the Supreme Court has ruled you can't make someone who is mentally competent, even if you think they're not, get off the street. And if it's not K Street, it's over on the over near the Kennedy Center. The freeways over there. There are all kinds of encampments there.
Yeah,
because they keep moving all the time.
Yes, because the mayor
and the city's struggling with this, and I don't think there's an easy answer other than to redouble our efforts with regard to homelessness.
Yeah, but homeless advocates will say put people in transitional housing before they can get to permanent housing.
The city is estimated to receive $280 million more in fiscal 2019 than initially expected. Where would you like to see that extra money go, speaking about homelessness?
Well, I can tell you that roughly half of that money is going to go to housing, affordable housing. And it's going to the Housing Production Trust Fund, but I think some of it could be redirected to some of what you're talking about, the transitional housing and the permanent supportive housing.
I think the mayor and Bowser's administration has done a lot to try to address homelessness. There's just no doubt about that.
Yes.
But you cannot make someone go into housing. People want, and they live on the street. They go to a housing problem. They can't maintain it. They don't have income to maintain it. There's all kinds of issues of why people are out there. I mean, I don't know if this would work or not, but is there a place where you can have an encampment for people to live? They want to be by themselves. They want to.
I don't think that's a solution.
I don't think so either. But if you're going to take them off the sidewalk, where do they go?
We're not alone in this problem by any means. Los Angeles is.
Oh, San Francisco is worse because President Trump likes to make fun of the people who are homeless there.
There are other cities and they're trying different strategies. Again, we should be redoubling our efforts with regard to homelessness. If a person is mentally ill to the point where they are a danger to themselves,
But that's a very difficult standard.
And I'm afraid we're just about out of time. The district being the only jurisdiction in this region that is required to provide homes for homeless people. And I'm afraid, as I said, that's all the time we
have. Let's have him back for the entire hour so we can grill him.
Phil Mendelson is the chairman of the D.C. Council. He's a Democrat. Chairman Mendelson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
Today's show is produced by Sydney Grant, and coming up Monday, we'll hear reactions from local veterans to the Afghanistan papers. And the newly crowned Miss America, who competed in the pageant as Miss Virginia 2019, will be here to share how she plans to use her national platform to change perceptions about beauty queens and about the pageant itself. Why? Because she is a scientist. She intends to show that a scientist can be Miss America and Miss America can be a scientist. That all starts at noon on Monday. Until then, you have a wonderful weekend plans, Tom Sherwood.
I'm going to the Anacostia Museum on Saturday to see a documentary on the reshaping of Southwest Washington.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Julie Deppenbrock, Sydney Grannon, Margaret Barthel, Lauren Marco, and Maura Curry. Our managing producer is Mona Cashby. Our engineer is Ben Privet. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nandi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.